Welcome to KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Is Seattle in a housing bubble? Can you know you're in a bubble when you're in a bubble? We'll take a look at that in just a few minutes. I hope you can stay tuned. First, though, our top story today. If you have walked around Capitol Hill lately, you might have seen big signs on telephone poles. Boycott Lost Lake Cafe, they say, with a screenshot of an article about rape accusations against cafe owner Dave Minard. The article is by KUOW's Sydney Brownstone, who's been following that story, and this morning published a second article at our website. Sydney Brownstone, thanks for coming in again.
Thanks for having me, Bill.
Dave Minard is a very influential person in Seattle. Not all of us know who he is, though. Would you remind us who he is?
Sure. So David Minard is a longtime fixture in Seattle's nightlife and political scene. He's launched several successful bars and restaurants on Capitol Hill and elsewhere. He ran the Capitol Hill Block Party for several years, and he's well known for chiming in on many issues affecting small business owners. The $15 minimum wage, for example, head tax. He got to start looking into the teen dance ordinance, if you remember that.
Yeah.
And he's been a longtime supporter of Dow Constantine, too.
And Sydney, how did you come to be reporting on these allegations?
Well, the first accuser I got a tip about when I was still working at The Stranger through connections through my coworkers. But I eventually found four more women with similar stories, and I published a piece detailing those allegations, for which the five women in total remained anonymous. And after that piece published, six more women came forward with their stories.
Right. What has been the fallout from this so far for Dave Minard, for his business interests?
So this was totally unintentional, but the first piece published during the week of Capitol Hill Block Party. So in the days following that, musicians were getting up on stage and making comments about rape culture. But a series of posters, as you mentioned, went up around Capitol Hill, and Dow Constantine and Jay Inslee divested themselves of David Minard's political donations. Minard's former business partner, Joey Burgess, also announced last week that Minard would no longer have a stake in Lost Lake and the Comet, which were two of his most well-known businesses. He remains the owner of the Five Point Cafe, and as far as I know, he's still invested in a venture on the ground floor of the Gridiron Building.
So you said these first five women whose accounts you published, they wanted to stay anonymous. But this morning, you have published more allegations from six more women, five of whom gave you their full names. What are they saying Minard did?
So like the first five women, they're also alleging a range of behavior. They're accusing Minard of various forms of sexual misconduct, including sexual assault. One woman said that Minard digitally penetrated her while they were having a conversation at a bar and her husband was in the next room. Another woman said that he tried to push her head onto his lap while they were in an Uber with then State Senator Cyrus Habib. The misconduct allegations run the gamut.
What does Dave Minard say about the allegations?
I made multiple attempts to reach David for this story, and he did not respond to more than 50 questions about the new allegations.
In the past, he has said he's made some statements.
Yeah, in the past, we had a long conversation in the offices of Strategies 360, the PR and crisis communications firm he hired to handle these allegations. But this time, he told me to send my questions by email and never responded.
By the way, that crisis communications firm is no longer working with him.
Yes, they dropped Minard as a client after they discovered that one of their own employees had her own Minard story. And she's one of the people who came forward to talk to me in this current story.
So, Sydney, some of these women have accused Minard of violating their consent. But in Washington state, that might not be provable in court. Why is that?
So in Washington state, victims must prove that there was a clear lack of consent. So there's a lot of room to interpret what that means, but it also means that some prosecutors want proof of lack of consent, like a witness who overheard screaming or proof of fighting, scratch marks, shouting, something like that. But there's, in addition to fight or flight, there's a third neurobiological response to trauma called the freeze response, where people just freeze. They're in shock. They don't do anything. So if you responded in that way, if you froze, you would have a tough time proving you didn't consent in court. The burden here, the legal burden, is on the victim and the state.
And that's in Washington state. It's not that way in all states, as you reported.
Yeah. So four states have what one legal researcher called a strict affirmative consent standard. So in other words, a lack of a no doesn't mean a yes. And in these states, the way I understand it is that some of the burden shifts from the victim to the accused to show that they obtained some form of consent, whether it be verbal or physical, body language cues, that kind of thing.
And which four states are those?
They are Montana, Wisconsin, New Jersey, and I am blanking on
Sorry about putting you on the spot, but I thought to ask because I guess I was a little surprised to see Montana or Wisconsin. You know, it just how these things change can really vary internally by state, and I wondered what's happening in Washington State around that.
Yeah, I mean, some of these states had very progressive state laws that were written, but sometimes it's also built up through case law. Like in New Jersey, for example, it was a state Supreme Court case that decided that a lack of a no was not a yes.
Mm-hmm. How important is it that 5 out of the 6 women to come forward today are giving their full names?
It's huge. I mean, as you know, it's been very common for journalism outlets and newspapers over the years to automatically omit the names of sexual assault accusers if they even ran those stories, which typically only covered stories of women who had criminal cases adjudicated in court. And the reason why these newspapers typically omitted the names is because of the stigma attached to sexual violence and the tendency for our society to blame the victim. But in some ways, never putting names on those accusations, never putting pictures on their faces, perpetuates that stigma. So, you know, by having names, by having these women coming forward and identifying themselves, it adds to the transparency of the story. I think it probably adds to their credibility, and it shows that maybe the stigma is beginning to recede.
Yeah, I wondered about that. How did people tell you, you know what, I'm not as scared as I would have been, or did some of the people you talked to, Sydney, say, this is still feels like a huge risk for me?
Yeah, I mean, they're definitely... I guess the dam kind of broke with the first story, but the women who came forward in the second story were still scared because it's their names on the line, it's their reputations on the line. But at the same time, several of the women kind of veered back and forth over the reporting process between one woman said, I'm not ashamed, and then thinking about everything that could be lost at the same time. So,
how about the reactions they've gotten from the people around them? Did they express any surprise at what has happened when they've told, in some cases, romantic partners or friends, colleagues?
Yeah, so I think a lot of people already knew about these allegations going back years, and that was an important part of the reporting for this piece, talking to people who had heard about this long before the first story published. So I think from some people close to these women, they had already known for a very long time. In certain scenes, people knew for a very long time about these types of allegations. But in terms of the bigger response, it's been pretty supportive of the women telling their stories.
So I guess we should talk about for whom this kind of reporting is more difficult. Like what kinds of people maybe have more to fear by coming forward than other people?
I mean, I think it cuts both ways. I think it depends. I think that if you are a successful business person and your name is well known, you have a lot to lose. But at the same time, if you're successful and you use your name, that adds to your credibility. People may be more willing to believe you if you are, for all intents and purposes, a nobody and you use your name. People can kind of project all sorts of motivations onto you that may not be there. So I think that there are risks in both directions depending on your stature in society.
Mm-hmm. KUOW's Sydney Brownstone has been reporting on this ongoing string of sexual assault and misconduct allegations against Seattle restaurateur and music scene member Dave Meinert. And again, this morning, fresh accusations were published. You can read the story at our website. Sydney, thanks for the update.
Thank you, Bill.
It's The Record on KUOW Seattle. We're going to be right back.